Okay, here we go. It's Wednesday night. First Wednesday of the month. That means it's Webster Griffin Tarpley night. And we're going to talk about Ukraine and things pertinent there, too. The latest from ITAR TASS, Switzerland imposes restrictions on the financial transactions for 33 Russian officials. And just beneath that, it says the U.S. has been indicted for bribery of Indian officials for obtaining their permission for development of some kind of oil or gas fields. It's in broken English there. But a Ukrainian oil oligarch named Firtash indicted in the U.S., okay, that's the key, for bribery. So lots of dirty things going on, financial punishments, restrictions, and now an indictment of a big-time player in the game. Lots of other headlines as well today. You won't see them because of the Fort Hood shooting tragedy, but there are lots of things going on. Webster, how's it look to you, my friend?
Just on the I don't want to talk about Fort Hood, but the news reports in the late afternoon had two shooters, and I believe that has now, as usual, morphed into one shooter.
Who's dead.
So
he is dead.
And that's the end of that. But there were two.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, I'm sure people have they've recorded the film clips of following these
things. Same old.
But at any rate, I think we have to focus on the big world geopolitics
and
I guess takes us to Ukraine
and
Russia. And here's what I wanted to do, something a little bit out of the ordinary. I would like to share the results of some research I've done into the history of Ukraine, right? What is Ukraine, after all? Some of us can remember when there was no Ukraine, at least as a country. And Ukraine as a country is a very, very new thing. There was Ukraine in 1918 and 1919 and into 1920, maybe. And that was the end of it. It was then incorporated into the USSR, Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, Soviet Union. And then we've had Ukraine from 1991, 92 on, essentially from December 1991 till now. So one of the things you see with Ukraine is this is a country which has had very little experience of self-government. And you see it, but there's no idea of, you know, peaceful transfer of power, elections, compromise, and so forth. And you learn some interesting things about that by looking at the instability of Ukraine, right? It's a divided country. They would do well, as I've tried to argue, they would do well to choose the path of neutralism, that is to put in their constitution that they will not join NATO, that they will not join the European Union, that they'll remain
independent.
Independent, neutral, nobody's alliance, and that they go to this system of I would call it confederalism. It would look like the U.S. under the Articles of Confederation.
Hmm.
So neutral and a confederation. Now, there's a very good example of a country that's been pretty successful. Actually, you just mentioned it. With that formula, right? Neutral.
Yeah.
It's a multi-ethnic country. It's got three or four languages. And it's neutral and it's a confederation. It's Switzerland.
Right. It's a very interesting country, Switzerland. Very few people understand the simplicity of it in the way you explain things.
I'm not recommending Switzerland for everybody, but for a place like Ukraine, this could be just the thing. Because you got to remember, at the time that Switzerland chose these things, it was a source of mercenaries, right? And it was constantly being fought over, rolled over, and looted, and wrecked, and so forth. So they chose this path, right, somewhat later on. And this was, I think, on the whole, they've been well served by this. Some people would say, well, what I'm arguing is Finlandization. I suppose it is. But Finland also did very well under this, right? Finland could have fared a whole lot worse, because you have to remember, they were in the war on the side of Hitler, although for their own reasons, right? It's a complicated story. But they could have been lumped together with the Nazis. That would have been easy. But instead, no. And one of the preconditions for Finland was you got to cool it in terms of internal politics. You can't have a raving anti-Russian party. You just can't allow that to go on. There's got to be a kind of a tacit gentleman's agreement that that kind of inflammatory rhetoric is just not good for the country, and people like that have to be isolated and essentially, made to count for nothing in elections and so forth, and not given any attention. The problem, of course, with Ukraine is that the fascists, the Russophobes, and so forth, are the ones who have control of the government. So this is a very big problem. But here, this was my starting point for Ukraine. I was looking at these press accounts, and the first thing you notice is that they're blaming the U.S., and I have to try to stand up for the U.S. when and where I can, and right. It's sometimes hard to find
the proper occasion, but when we can,
we want to do it. And for the American people, above all, and try to defend them against useless wars.
The good American people, and there are damn lots of them out there.
Yeah, and this would be one case where the American people would benefit from a little defense, right, from people who know what's going on. These Ukrainians say, oh, you betrayed us. You betrayed us. You should be doing much more. Where's your military deployment? Where are your crippling sanctions? Where's this? Where's that? And I thought to myself, well, this is a fairly arrogant approach. And then I thought, well, I thought of actually what I guess it was Johnson said it and Nixon said it, right, saying, well, we're willing to help all sorts of people, but those Asian boys in those days, those Asian boys have to take the main responsibility for their own countries. And when you look at Ukraine, you say, well, you're so nationalistic, right? You're so full of glory to Ukraine, but you won't fight. You just won't fight. The Ukrainians will not fight. They wouldn't fight for the border, for Crimea. They wouldn't fight for their fleet, for their ships, for their army bases, for their headquarters, for their anything else, right? They just wouldn't lift a finger.
Who told them not to? Anybody? Or was it just something that they just didn't want to do?
I would say it's possible that Obama told them not to. That was the famous the meeting when Yatsenyuk went to the White House, and we have this, it's a strange case. We have a cryptic summary coming from Professor Stephen Cohen of NYU, who is a Russophile. And he's actually not only a Russophile, he's a follower of Nikolai Bukharin, which I would say is not a name you don't hear very often.
Yeah.
Bukharin, in other words, the right wing of the Bolsheviks. That's who he is.
Yeah.
But fine. He wants to in today's world, he wants to have a useful role, I think, which is that he's also the husband of Katrina Vandenhoevel of the Nation, right? And then the left wing of the intelligence establishment, right? Which is what that is. So he wants to say that the Russians have, they have their own case, right? That they have their side of the story. Absolutely. So he said, when Yatsenyuk got to the White House, this is the Professor Cohen talking on, I guess it must be Chris Hayes, MSNBC, and he's telling Chris Hayes, when Yatsenyuk got to the White House, this is about 2 weeks ago now, Yatsenyuk was talking crazy. So they took him into the White House and gave him a history lesson, and when he came out, he was not talking crazy. Now, I don't know what that means. I don't know who can give history lessons. Right? This is not the strong forte of the Obama administration. But the one thing you do see is that in spite of what some might interpret, Obama is not very energetic in this stuff. He is not out in front. When Yatsenyuk went to the White House, it's clear Yatsenyuk wanted to come out and say, I've been promised immediate membership in NATO. Not a word, not a word. And according to Cohen, Yatsenyuk was told to tone it down, cool it, and that might include, don't start shooting, because if you do, you're on your own. That's perfectly feasible, because Obama would say, that's bad for Obama.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But that's all right. Yeah, at least he's got that much.
Yeah, all right. Now,
better than nothing. Better than a neocon.
I call him Ratsenyuk, but you can call him Yatsenyuk if you want.
I call him Yats the Rat.
Well, Rat's the Yat. All right, we can go around and around with this. Who's on first? The Rat, no matter how you cut it.
The Rat.
The guy looks like a rat. He's a very unfortunate...
I compared him in one of my talks to a squirrely guy.
Yeah, okay. He has a very unfortunate countenance for international political leadership, as it were. He looks like a rat. All right, we're going to keep going here. I want to hear more about this. Go ahead.
So, and the other thing I would say is, remember, there was a request by the Ukrainian government to the United States for immediate NATO emergency military aid. And the answer was no, according to the Wall Street Journal. No. And you have these sanctions, right? Some little sanctions against the oligarchs around Putin. I, for one, am not going to be up tonight crying about those oligarchs, right? Maybe they could do with a little, diet.
Yeah, hear you.
Right? They're a great liability, a grave liability to Putin, and they also prevent him from implementing better economic plans, which I think he might otherwise do. And you notice that Obama's posture is sort of saying, well, I really want to do more, but those Europeans, right, they're so dependent on Russia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Blame anybody but himself.
I think this is important, though, because you look on the other side, look what's coming out of the mouths of Kagan, Krauthammer, Romney, Cheney, any Republican. The Republicans have dropped the mask, and it's all that libertarian claptrap about how they were, you know, not interested in foreign wars. They are, and they've shown it this time. And little Rand Paul at the beginning of all this, was attempting to look like he was a libertarian, right, that he didn't want to get involved in foreign wars.
Well, that
and
went by the
he's been moving
boards.
Towards the warmongers ever since.
He
in
certainly
other words,
has.
Yeah. Little Rand is a really despicable little opportunist. But here's what
he is drowning in his own arrogance, his own narcissism. All he wants is to get a shot at the White House. He'll take vice president. He just wants in. The guy is driven. He's obsessed with himself.
Well, yes, and he's a silver spoon oligarch, right? He's a papa's boy, and he represents the southern jurisdiction of the Scottish Rites of Freemasonry, right?
That's something that people don't know about. Ron Paul is involved with the Freemasons as well.
And little Rand was a member of this thing at I think Baylor University, and it's called the Nosy Brotherhood. And this was when he was molesting some woman that she had to bow down to Aqua Buddha, was the resident deity of the Nazi brotherhood. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's the story with them. But the Republicans are warmongers. What it shows you is that Obama is not the worst of all possible worlds. And I regard it as a waste of time to make Obama the main target, right? Pick out the people that are most vociferous in favor of immediate war. And attack them, right? And it's not Obama. It's certainly not. But anyway,
who is it's not the Republican neocons.
It is the neocons. It's the neocons in the sense of, as I said, Kagan, Krauthammer, the people who would have been the foreign policy team for Romney. They're the ones who want war. Now they can't.
But
say
nobody
they
in the current administration. Nobody in the current administration. Rice doesn't.
No,
not
well,
rice,
it,
not
they,
rice, not
I don't
rice.
Know what they want. I mean, I shudder to think what they want. But in terms of what they've said in public, at least, there's no. In other words, the posture of these neocons is that Obama's a wimp, Obama's a patsy, Obama needs to do much more. Now, when you start asking them, well, do you want World War III? Then, oh no, we just want him to do more. Well, what? And they won't tell you. So. I think what it shows is that the bellicose enthusiasm of Obama is pretty thin. It's pretty weak broth. But let me get back to what I think is really interesting about Ukraine. The question with Ukraine is, now that you've seen these glorious right sector fascists and the Svoboda group, they don't lift a finger. And there's also this other thing. That they've put out, I think, I'm counting by now, 4, or is it 5 calls to mobilize the reservists of the army, mm-hmm. and people have not come forward. Mm-hmm. Maybe 10,000 for a country of 55 million. Mm-hmm. This is not so great. So I think what it shows is that there's a really minimal willingness to lift a finger, partly for this government, right, the Turchinov, Yatsenyuk, Yatsarat government. But I also think there's a big question about Ukraine itself. In other words, is that really a country? That's the question that I would like to ask.
Well, they don't have a thousand-year-old heritage to lean on, that's for sure.
Well, they would say maybe that they do in the following limited sense, that in 988, you have the Grand Duke Vladimir of Kiev, and he's the head of something that is called, in retrospect, the Kiev Rus, or Kievan Rus, mm-hmm. which at that time meant Russia. In other words, that was mm-hmm. Russia.
Right.
And they didn't... Ukraine is a funny word. Ukraine means, I understand, something like to the border, by the border, at the border. The Kiev Rus did not think of itself as a border. It thought it was a pretty central thing. And it never called itself Ukraine. In other words, I'm not sure exactly when that word pops
well,
up.
It sounds like it might appear on a Russian menu in a restaurant somewhere. We'll have two helpings of Ukraine, please. Light on the garlic.
All right. So here's the thing, though. That Kiev Rus, by the way, people maybe are not aware, but between the Black Sea and the Baltic, there is this inland waterway, and it's the Dnieper River going north, and then you reach a point where a short portage carrying your canoe over land, right, will lead you to a river system that goes to the Baltic and to Sweden and beyond, right? So there's a, in the whole Dark Ages, especially.
If you go up to Dnieper, you can get to Sweden?
Yes.
I'm surprised they haven't put a canal in there.
I mean, historically, they did. Again, it's not water all the way. It may be now, if a canal was built to connect it, right?
That's kind of interesting. Yeah.
And the point is that the Vikings often worked as mercenaries for the Byzantine emperor. When you see something like the Vikings conquering Normandy mm-hmm. in France, mm-hmm. that's you think they're being prodded by the Byzantine emperor. The other important one is the Vikings conquer Sicily at a certain point, and you think, who did that? That looks like it's the Byzantine emperor. Or even the Norman conquest of England, right? The government in England at that time was one of the better ones. And the Byzantine Empire, I don't think, liked it very much. So they said, "Why, hey, you Norman French, we have the intelligence. Why don't you attack King Harold, and let's have the Battle of Hastings, and then he'll lose and you'll win." So this is the point that I was trying to make is that Kiev originates as a city along this north-south route of Vikings, and they have a special name, Varangians. If you look into this, you'll see. The Varangian. It just means Swedes
well,
or Vikings.
You've had your nose buried in some history books. That's
okay, but you notice what it is. This is created from the outside. That's the point. It's not something that grows up from the steppes. It comes from these, you know, rather, well, Byzantium at that point, the richest city in Western, you know, in Europe, certainly. And then these Vikings. All right. But now, where does Ukraine then appear? I went and looked at various historical maps, and if you look at, say, Europe during the Wars of Religion, right, in the 1500s, there's no right. Ukraine. It's a lot of times it's part of the Ottoman Empire, and this is what happened, right, that Kiev Rus was conquered by the Mongols in the 1200s, and then it began to get conquered partly by Poland in particular, but also then by the Ottoman Empire. So Ukraine, you don't see any Ukraine, right? And then you see the Russian Empire begin to come in. So the first mention of Ukraine, I have a map from an Englishman in 1747 where he puts something called Little Russia. That's what Ukraine was often called, or Ruthenia, right? Have you ever heard that? Ruthenia
no.
is the way a Latin speaker or a scholar in Europe would have heard this Rus, right?
Little Russia. Is that an insult like Little Rand?
No. This is a well-established thing that you have White Russia, Belarus, you have Little Russia, you even have Red Russia, Red Russia being the area south of this place, Lemberg or Lvov, right? The center of all these fascists, right? The Munich of the current fascism is this place, Lvov or Lemberg.
Well, that's very interesting because the Second Symphony of Tchaikovsky is called The Little Russian.
The Little Russian, exactly, yes, right. It just means the Ukrainian symphony, but notice they don't call it that. They call it The Little Russian. Now, this,
you're supposed
these
to
are
be impressed
Russians
with my knowledge of Tchaikovsky.
No, it's very important. I looked this up, too. So it's about, by my count, it's about 1774 that the Russians get all the way to the Black Sea coast, right? They drive the Tartars out, and they drive the Ottoman Empire out, and they take over. So they're by 1800, the Russians have the whole north coast.
Now, just to clear up one thing, we have to break here. The Tartars and the Tatars,
the same word,
are the
just
same thing.
How you're getting it, you know?
But
what
yeah,
does it sound like to you?
Exactly. It's always been Tartar.
Beefsteak Tartar. I like think in English, Tartar is better because people have heard it. Right?
Well, steak tartare, it's a horrible dish. It's raw hamburger, basically.
If you like it.
You like it?
No, I'm not interested, but some people like it, sure.
It's I used to make it when I worked in a restaurant. It's ground round, all kinds of seasonings, olive oil, salt, pepper, garlic, and it's ultimately shaped into sort of a patty, but it's ground round. It's
kind of
oblong.
The New York term for this is cannibal sandwich.
A cannibal steak. And then they actually make a little depression in it and crack a raw egg,
it
floats in the middle of steak tartare. No thank you. All right, we'll be right back. No comment. All right. Webster and I will be right back. Okay, back with Webster. And no, I did not used to eat steak tartare. I actually was forced by my grandfather, who was a chef, to take one bite of it once when I was about 12. That was plenty for me, no more. Raw hamburger. That was before Mad Cow was around. Okay, onward with the interesting...
Jeff, you gotta let me focus now, because if I'm gonna do justice to this stuff, I gotta use the time now.
You got it.
Directly. So look, here's the idea. By the 1700s, much of current Ukraine is part of Poland. And you have to remember, Poland in those days was actually, it was a monarchy. It was an elective monarchy. It was very big.
It
went from the Baltic to the Black Sea, right?
Yeah.
Really big. And there were Polish landowners who had as much land as a duke or a count in Germany or Italy or someplace like this. So Poland, of course, had an extremely incompetent government. One of these days we could do a comparison of our government problems with the case of Poland, because it was an extreme form of oligarchy. One of the most pathological examples of oligarchy we have in European history is the so-called Polish Republic. But the point is that a lot of Ukraine, just about all of it, at least all the way up to Kiev, coming from the west all the way up to Kiev, all of that was Polish. And then when the misrule of the Polish oligarchy, right, the nobility of Poland, drove the country to rack and ruin, the place was carved up, right? And Prussia or Germany took parts, Austria took other parts, and Russia took the largest part of Ukraine. So the only thing you need to know is this east-west divide in Ukraine goes back to the difference between the parts that were assigned to Russia and then these other parts around Lvov, Lemberg, that were put into the Austrian Empire. This is called Galicia. But still, where does this come from? Who starts talking about Ukraine? Well, the first people who do this are typically these romantic historians. And you know, in the late 19th century, there's a movement in different countries, the Czechs have it, the Romanians have it, everybody has it to some degree. The Greeks have had it a little bit earlier, to get romantic historians who try to say, well, we've been submerged here for a couple of hundred years, but we're really here, and we're really Ukrainian. And the idea is to say, we're not Russian, and we're not Polish, we are Ukrainian. And the people who say this are really a group of political dreamers. One of them is Mikhailo Khrushchevsky, right? Sounds like Khrushchev, but no, it's Khrushchevsky.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a historian. And then you have the great, the national poet, I guess, of Ukraine is Taras Shevchenko. He's also at the same time. But this is just, it's like an academic fad or a romantic fad. It doesn't have any political traction until World War One. Now, in World War One, as soon as this starts, you've got Germany and Austria-Hungary, right, facing off against Russia, and that's the Eastern Front. And there's a great desire, especially by the Germans, to find ways to bust up the Russian Empire by appealing to the subject nationality. Now, I want to quote a German historian, Frank Golchevsky, of the University of Hamburg. I'll have this as an essay on my website within 24 hours or so. Go to Tarpley.net tomorrow, and you'll find it.
Shoot
so
me
this
a link.
Golchevsky. Here's what he says.
Yeah.
In September 1914, intellectuals come forward. Some of them are refugees from Russia. Some of them are from the Austrian part of Ukraine. And they say, look, Germans, there is Ukraine. And the Germans say, what? They have no idea. They've never heard of it. The Austrians in Vienna are better informed. They know that there is Ukraine. But the Berlin, they don't seem to know this very well. So they order up a whole raft of ethnographic reports, and they study them, and they say, by gosh, there is something here that could be called Ukraine, right? Because it's a language which is different from Russian and different from Polish. You might say it's a dialect of Russian which has evolved under the influence of Polish or something like that. But anyway, there's not much of a literature, but they can concoct this. So immediately, the Germans say, all right, first of all, we're going to give you money, books, pamphlets, newspapers, propaganda, right, all kinds of stuff to show that there needs to be an independent Ukraine outside of the Russian Empire. Some of them say it should be under Austria. Some of them say it should be completely independent. That doesn't matter at the moment. Now, here's where Ukrainian. You have the idea of Ukraine, right? As Cavour said, I made Italy, now I have to make Italians, right? In this case, you got the idea of Ukraine. Where are the Ukrainians? So the Germans say, we know what to do. This is now the German General Staff. It's basically Field Marshal von Hindenburg and General Ludendorff. And these are really bad people, but they're really wild. They are really, they've described as witch doctors, I guess, in terms of political dabbling. The Germans say, look, we have about 50,000 prisoners of war who can be associated with these areas that might be called Ukraine. So they get these POWs in the German camps, and they say to them, look, you want to be exempt from work? Da. You want to get special treatment? Da. Then you have to come to our classes. We're going to put you in a special camp. We're going to take you back to Germany, and then we're going to give you courses. You're going to get courses in Ukrainian language, Ukrainian history, and some other things. And first, at the beginning, it's a failure because these peasant soldiers are not interested in Ukraine. Right? They've never heard of it. They don't know what it means. It's not real to them. Then the Germans say, all right, look, in that case, what we'll do is we'll give you courses in agronomy, how to run a farm. And then the peasants say, all right, now you're talking. Because they have this idea, right, that the Russian Empire is collapsing and there's going to be a land reform and the estates are going to be broken up. And they might get some land. And, of course, every peasant from time immemorial has had one ruling passion, which is to get their own land. And the more, the better.
Yeah.
So they also teach them communism. Because remember, communism is to some degree the byproduct of the German General Staff, right? Shipping Lenin.
So they taught them communism and agronomism.
Yeah. Communism, so agronomy, and also Ukraine and why Russia is bad and so forth. So they ship them back, and they have 10,000 of them that they can send back in. So these are your cadre who go into Ukraine and start saying, hey, you guys, you're Ukrainian. Right? And they have some results. Okay? So the next step is what happens after the first days of the Russian Revolution in February 1917.
We'll jump into that in just a couple of minutes.
We'll try to get through that, huh?
Yeah, hold on a second. You'll make it. We'll be right back with Webster. Ladies and gentlemen, let's get right back to Mr. Tarpley. All right, Professor, go right ahead.
So far we've got all of these Ukrainian prisoners of war, Russians, but they're calling themselves Ukrainians, now sent back in by the German general staff to agitate. The main idea is chaos, right? They want to break up the Russian Empire. Now, the Russian Tsar gets overthrown in the February 1917 First Russian Revolution. And at this point, the Ukrainian Rada appears in Kiev. Now, Rada is just the translation of Soviet, right? Council. That's all it means. But this is now petty bourgeois, right? It's doctors, lawyers working for businessmen, property owners, bankers, latifundists, and so forth. So it's a right-wing thing, this Rada, starting in 1917. The Bolsheviks, right, the communists, set up their own government in Kharkov, right? We've been hearing about Kharkov. By December 1917, there's a rival Ukrainian government in Kharkov. So how is this decided? Now, in this little town of Brest-Litovsk, right, people may have heard the name from the famous treaty, there's now a negotiation between Germany and Russia primarily. But other people show up too, right? Vienna, Austria shows up, the Turks show up, the Romanians, and some Ukrainians show up, right? So the main event going on is a big tirade between the German delegates and the Russian delegates. One of them is Trotsky. Mm-hmm. But then at the edge of this, right, as a byproduct of the Russian-German talks, there is then this first appearance of Ukraine on the map ever. And that's the so-called bread peace, bread, food, of February 9th, 1918. Now, this is the British are running this sea blockade, and the U.S. has joined it by now, right, because it's 1918. So everybody in Central Europe is in danger of starving. And in Vienna, there are food riots, and in Germany, the situation is terrible, malnutrition everywhere. Mm-hmm. So they're interested in food. Now, the thing with Ukraine is the Black Earth region is great for farming. It's one of the things that the West wants to loot this time around. So the German and the Austro-Hungarian delegation say, look, Ukraine, we're willing to sign a treaty with you. Mm-hmm. You have declared your independence. We want you to insist on your complete independence from the Russian Empire. Mm-hmm. And we want you to be a separate independent state because that's the only way we can sign a treaty with you. And here's the idea. You become independent. We'll defend your independence. So what's the price, right? What do Berlin and Vienna want? Well, they want food. And here's what they want. It's built into the agreement. They want, from Ukraine, 1 million tons of grain, 400 million eggs, 50,000 tons of beef. They want bacon, sugar, hemp, linseeds, manganese ore, and other products. And that's the bread piece. So you see what they're interested in. They're saying, basically, you, the Ukrainian Rada, are the administration of the delicatessen of the German army, right? The German general staff. And that is how, for the first time, and you pick up the New York Times, as I've seen it, pick up the New York Times, February 17th, 1918. There's a big map. It says dismembered Russia, some of the fragments, and then you see Ukraine, right? But here's the problem. It does not go well because the Rada is incompetent, right? These are, a lot of them are aristocrats. They're landowners. They're not well-liked. They're oppressive, right? And the thing is, the Germans expect a lot of food fast, and it doesn't materialize because the peasants go into a sabotage mode, passive resistance, hide crops, do all sorts of things to prevent the stuff from being taken away.
Okay, about 7 minutes.
Okay, so at that point, the Germans put in a dictator. But this is the beginning of it. You see what I mean? It's the delicatessen of Germany, and it doesn't last because, first of all, you have these white armies, right? Wrangel and Denikin, the monarchists, the czarists, who try to come in. It's interesting that during this phase, France seizes Sevastopol, which we've been seeing so much of, and Odessa. So the two biggest ports there in southern Russia on the Black Sea were seized by the French in 1918-1919, which if you put that together with the Crimean War, 1853-1856, when England and France attacked precisely the Crimea, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You can see why the Russians would say, well, wait a minute, this is the avenue of invasion, so we better get that under our control. So they put the Germans then put in a dictator. They kick out the Rada, they arrest them, and they bring in a dictator with the idea that they're going to try even harder to squeeze the peasants to get this food. And some of the Germans realize at this point that what is happening is that the harder the Germans bite the Ukrainian peasants, the more the Ukrainian peasants long to go back to Moscow, communist though it may be. And that is then what happens. We have some really interesting quotes. When you look at this article, it's really uncanny, right? And essentially that the German generals don't realize it, but they're driving the Ukrainians back into the arms of the Bolsheviks, right? They're making the Bolsheviks look good. Now, as a result of all this, right, they eventually Ukraine is incorporated into the new Soviet Union, right? 1922, Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, Ukrainian SSR is a part of it. Now, the whole western part, Lvov, that stays in Poland, right? That's now under Marshal Pilsudski of Poland. But here's the idea. As a result of this, and this is my my German historian, Golchevsky again, Ukraine has been considered made in Germany. Ukraine as a German invention.
Modern Ukraine.
Modern Ukraine. And that's the only one there is, because there's nothing until 1918, there's nothing official on the map.
I got it.
That's called Ukraine.
Okay.
So, especially the people who have this theory that I've just said, made in Germany.
Uh-huh.
This is Poland, right? Polish people of all types will argue, or did argue, there's no such thing as a Ukrainian. These were invented by the Germans, and the British and the French also went along with it. There's a Ukrainian Jewish writer by the name of Joseph Roth, and he writes in 1939, Ukrainians, Ukraine is made in Germany. The Germans invented Ukraine in order to smash the Russian Empire. The essence of Ukraine is it's a fifth column for Germany. Now, the other thing important is that when Ukraine gets these breathing spaces of independence, right? 1919, they're still going.
Yeah.
And then again in 1941.
3 minutes.
As soon as they're on their own, they go into this pogrom mode. They start killing Jews. Some of them kill Poles and others, but Jews are constantly being targeted. So you go through all this, and then you can also add that the creation of the independent Ukraine in 1991 is also top-down. In other words, there really is not a movement for the independence of Ukraine. Rather, what it is the ruler of Kiev, right, under the Soviets, Leonid Kravchuk, says, well, after the Moscow coup of August 1991, my best bet for staying in power is to declare independence, and I can play the card of nationalism and keep my oligarchical power going. And that is pretty much what happened. Very interesting. In the early part of 1991, right, the last year of the Soviet Union, there was a referendum, do you want to stay in the USSR? And that was 75% of Ukrainians voted yes on March 17th, 1991. But after the August coup, right, with the KGB trying to take over Moscow, and after the announcement that there was going to be shock therapy in Ukraine, right, which was October, after that, in December 1991, 90% of the Ukrainians vote to leave the USSR. So to sum it up, you got Alsace-Lorraine in mind. It goes back between France and Germany. Mm-hmm. It's French, it's German, it's French, it's German, it's French, it's German. And, sometimes big wars accompany these transitions.
Right.
Ukraine is typically a place that goes back and forth between Russia, Poland, Turkey, Austria. It's a kind of a geopolitical football. And I would say the main lesson from this is it's not worth World War III. It's not worth anything like World War III. And above the main point is that the Ukrainians are not willing to fight for their own country. So Americans certainly should not.
Well, you did it all with 1 minute to spare. All right. Well,
questions, comments, criticism.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. All I know is that when the Orange Revolution failed, the plotters went into Plan B, which cost $5 billion, allegedly.
Well, I think that's over a longer time. I mean, she says we invested $5 billion. Let me just add one other thing. This, the Holodomor. No, but since the basis of Ukrainian nationality is so tenuous, they say, well, the thing that unites us is that we were starved by Stalin in 1932-33.
Holodomor, yeah.
I would point to Annie Lacroix-Ri of the University of Paris, number 7, eminent French historian. And her research is that this is a complete invention. In other words, there was a food shortage, but it's not just Ukraine. It's in the Caucasus. It's in Kazakhstan. And the people who talk about famine and deliberate are the Nazi embassy and the fascist Italian embassy. The French embassy says, well, there's some food shortage. And then it's taken over by William Randolph Hearst, spread throughout the world. So
there's one of those
Holodomor is also untenable.
Well, one of those stories that we probably will never know the full
ramifications. Oh, no, we do. I mean, I think we do know it. It's a fraud.
Well, photos, there's some photos out there, too. Of course, photos can be misrepresented and are often in history. You know,
and indeed, there was a food shortage. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But again, you know, these people today, they attribute everything to climate. Does that mean we had the Dust Bowl in the United States? That was real. In the 1930s, there was the Dust Bowl. Well, at the same time, there was something similar in Ukraine.
Now we got the Radiation Bowl from Fukushima, and that's real. We know that much. Thank you, Webster.
Ukraine has about 15 nuclear reactors, and you don't want to have a war going around with
we need to shut those things down. Thank you. That was really interesting. Good homework, and gives us a better perspective. We'll see what happens here shortly. All righty.
Check toply.net.
Very good. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Night.
A confederation. Now, there's a very good example of a country that's been pretty successful. Actually, you just mentioned it. With that formula, right? Neutral.
Yeah.
It's a multi-ethnic country. It's got three or four languages, and it's neutral, and it's a confederation. It's Switzerland.
Right? It's a very interesting country, Switzerland. Very few people understand the simplicity of it in the way you explain things.
I'm not recommending Switzerland for everybody, but for a place like Ukraine, this could be just the thing. Because you got to remember, at the time that Switzerland chose these things, it was a source of mercenaries, right? And it was constantly being fought over and, rolled over and looted and wrecked and so forth. So they chose this path, right, somewhat later on. And this was, on the whole, they've been well served by this. Some people would say, well, what I'm arguing is Finlandization. I suppose it is. But Finland also did very well under this, right? Finland could have fared a whole lot worse because you have to remember they were in the war on the side of Hitler, although for their own...
You, my friend.
Just on the, I don't want to talk about Fort Hood, but the news reports in the late afternoon had two shooters, and I believe that has now, as usual, morphed into one shooter.
Who's dead.
So
he is dead.
And that's the end of that. But there were two.
Yeah.
And you can, I'm sure people have they've recorded the film clips up there.
Yep.
Following these
things. Same old.
But at any rate, I think we have to focus on the big world geopolitics
and that,
I guess, takes us to Ukraine and Russia. And here's what I wanted to do, something a little bit out of the ordinary. I would like to share the results of some research I've done into the history of Ukraine, right? What is Ukraine, after all? Some of us can remember when there was no Ukraine, at least as a country. And Ukraine as a country is a very, very new thing. There was Ukraine in 1918 and 1919 and into 1920, maybe, and that was the end of it. It was then incorporated into the USSR, Union of Soviet...
Okay, here we go. It's Wednesday night, first Wednesday of the month. That means it's Webster Griffin Tarpley night, and we're going to talk about Ukraine and things pertinent there, too. The latest from ITAR TASS Switzerland imposes restrictions on the financial transactions for 33 Russian officials. And just beneath that, it says the U.S. has been indicted for bribery of Indian officials for obtaining their permission for development of some kind of oil or gas fields. It's in broken English there. But a Ukrainian oil oligarch named Firtash indicted in the U.S., okay, that's the key, for bribery. So lots of dirty things going on, financial punishments, restrictions, and now an indictment of a big-time player in the game. Lots of other headlines as well today. You won't see them because of the Fort Hood shooting tragedy, but there are lots of things going on. Webster, how's it look to you?
Socialist republics, Soviet Union. And then we've had Ukraine from 1991-92 on, essentially from December 1991 till now. So one of the things you see with Ukraine is this is a country which has had very little experience of self-government. And you see it, but there's no idea of, you know, peaceful transfer of power, elections, compromise, and so forth. And you learn some interesting things about that by looking at the instability of Ukraine. Right? It's a divided country. They would do well, as I've tried to argue, they would do well to choose the path of neutralism, that is to put in their constitution that they will not join NATO, that they will not join the European Union, that they'll remain
independent,
neutral, yeah. Nobody's alliance, yeah. And that they go to this system of, I would call it confederalism. It would look like the U.S. under the Articles of Confederation.
Hmm.
So neutral and reason, right? It's a complicated story, but they could have been lumped together with the Nazis. That would have been easy. But instead, no. And one of the preconditions for Finland was you got to cool it in terms of internal politics. And you can't have a raving anti-Russian party. You just can't allow that to go on. There's got to be a kind of a tacit gentleman's agreement that kind of inflammatory rhetoric is just not good for the country. And people like that have to be isolated and essentially, made to count for nothing in elections and so forth, and not given any attention. The problem, of course, with Ukraine is that the fascists, the Russophobes, and so forth, are the ones who have control of the government. So this is a very big problem. But here, this was my starting point for Ukraine. I was looking at these press accounts, and the first thing you notice is that they're blaming the U.S., and I have to try to stand up for the U.S. when and where I can, and right. It's sometimes hard to find.
Now, just don't make a habit of it. Huh?
But